So,
are we recording?
Yep.
Let me talk in my recording voice.
Really?
Nope.
Oh.
That's all I got is one voice.
Do we know which one we're doing right now?
No, you just hit record and didn't even
tell me anything.
What you got right there?
I'm going to tell you guys. Mary brought me a 4-month coin. Do you call it a coin?
Yeah.
Coin?
Yeah. It's your coin?
It's my 4-month sobriety coin. And it's funny that you sent I looked and like I know I've said this before, I haven't been to a meeting since I stopped drinking, but turns out I ended up at a meeting this week at 6:30 in the morning because I had such a bad night before. I had bad days before, and then the night just kind of hit me and I was like, "All right, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to drink." And I ended up at a meeting at 6:30 in the morning and but I found a bunch of 24-hour coins from when I tried to quit drinking back in the winter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I had them all in a little box on my dresser that I just never open. It's just for pretty. And I opened it, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
How many of those did you get?
I think there's 5 or 6 in right now. And I know that's not even all of them. Mm-hmm. How many I threw away, I don't even know.
I didn't realize you were getting them.
I was.
I mean, you weren't telling anyone.
No, I wasn't telling anyone. But I went to 11 meetings in a row. So I bet you I have 11.
So you would go to the meeting, drink, and then start again the next day?
Yep.
Because I remember that. You were like, 30 days, 30 meetings. Yep. Or something like that.
I think they even go as far as saying 90 meetings is what they say. And I think I went to 11, I think. Yeah. Yeah. So this, and I don't know if I didn't feel like I deserved one. But it just, I don't know. It was weird that I found that box and then I got my first coin.
Yay.
And you're supposed to carry that around, right?
Yeah. Chris carries it in his wallet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or in his pocket. He used to carry one in his pocket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I see that a lot. I see a lot of people rub them while they're. There was a woman at the meeting the other morning, and she got her 6-month coin, and they pass it around and let everybody rub it or pray over it. And
that's what they do.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever seen anybody get a big one, and
because you're supposed to be there to inspire.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So it was good.
That's when we went back at 1 year for Chris's. Mm-hmm. 1 year anniversary, but we went to back to the rehab place that he was in long term, and I had maybe only been to one or two meetings at that point, and they give like it's actually your sponsor is supposed to give you a coin, but you don't have a sponsor, and so that was just like, I'm allowed to give you that coin. Your sponsor gives it to you, and then everyone in the room. It passes around.
Yeah.
Everyone holds it. It's like a thing.
That was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, so now I have one. I keep it with me.
Cool.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so Chris had his 2-year on Saturday, and I had my 4 months on Sunday.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a big weekend for...
It was a big weekend for
people
drunks.
I love that don't drink anymore. Drunks.
I only say that because there's a story about that earlier. Sorry. Inside joke. I know those don't.
Inside joke on a podcast.
I know. It doesn't work, does it? Should I just tell them the story?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Mary saw on Instagram, which you knew my 4 months was coming up anyway, but you saw on Instagram, I usually just put the number of where I am, and it was 4 months. And you said, hey, I'm actually worried about Jesse and you and Chris and the girls were at dinner. You're like, this is their 4 months and I know that things are bumpy. And Chris said, well, give me your number and I'll text her. And he did text me and he texted me, which Chris didn't have my number. So I don't have his number. There's never been a reason for us to have each other's phone numbers. And so he texted me on Sunday and he said, this is Chris, 4 months is a long time for a drunk to go without a drink. I'm proud of you. And I was like, who the hell is calling me a drunk? There were a number of Chris's that it could have been that I wouldn't have had their numbers, and it would have made sense that they kind of would have known or would have seen it on the internet. And so I sent the number to to a friend and said, "Hey, do you have this number in your?" Yes, he did, and it was. He was like, "That's Chris Graham," and I was like, "Oh, oh, okay. Well, then that's fine.
You can call me a drunk. It's fine."
That's what I said. I realize now, just going to that meeting, it's almost like a term of endearment amongst alcoholics. Mm-hmm. So,
like admitting this is what I am.
This is what I am, and this acceptance, and it's ugly, and yeah, this is just the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no pretty term for alcoholics. Well, we've talked about that in past episodes where people are really trying to frou-frou it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not on board. I have tried
but
to
you
follow.
Were. You
I
was were,
on
though.
I
like
was
that's,
on board.
Yeah.
Yes, I was on board at one point. But I was on board because I didn't want to get sober.
Yeah, you were still clinging tight to, like, control or lack of self-awareness and addiction. Like,
There's just all
rationalization,
the ways,
all the things.
It was. So I started following a lot of these accounts, like 1,000 hours sober. And it's just all of these people that are just not, like, they're just on hiatus from drinking for a little bit. And it's like some claim to.
It's also cool to talk about.
It's so cool
addiction
right now.
Oh my
gosh. It's so cool to talk about it. And it's so cool to. Which any literature that you read right now about it, that millennials are just choosing to not drink more than any other generation before. Mm-hmm. And that's great.
Yeah,
I'm 100% on board with that. But making it like this boutique-y type, pretty, bright colors and quotes and all this. And I'm like, no, you have not been in the shit.
No. And there's also, like, in lots of ways, our generation and the one that's directly, you know, the people that are in their 20s right now, like, it has become like in vogue to be very self-aware and to brag about therapy, mm-hmm. and to, like, here are all my issues and trauma, blah blah, but it's all at a surface level as
very
opposed
much.
To like
it's
actual
yes.
hard work, because
yes.
that's a different conversation.
I agree. It's they're retaining all the information, they're not using it, they're not applying it, they're really just They're retaining the information to regurgitate it, like just to spit it back out at somebody else to make them appear that they're mentally healthy or to diagnose and label other people.
Yeah.
And that makes me nuts.
And I see that on Instagram a lot, of like girls that try to be all like, guys, I'm just suffering with anxiety. My anxiety is so hard right now. Like, and I'm not making fun of anxiety. Mm-hmm. I understand what anxiety looks like in my own life and in people I love. But that there's no accountability behind I struggle with anxiety besides kind of bragging that you have it as an excuse to not do things or to not be able to work hard at something because you have anxiety. Admitting you have anxiety is fine, but if you are just saying it to tell someone as opposed to, I have anxiety and here are the skills I'm working on, or here's the medicine I'm on that's helping me get a handle on some things, or here's the therapy I'm doing, or here's the books I'm reading that are I'm trying to heal some of those wounds. Mm-hmm. Just having anxiety and reminding everyone on the internet that you have anxiety is gets under my skin.
I thought you were going to say grind my gears.
I almost did. I was like, but that's that sounds like something my grandpa would say. So I didn't. And that's, I think, in the same vein of, like, I'm not drinking. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm not drinking or what it means for, like, my health or sobriety or what issues I might have tied to drinking. I'm just not going to drink for 30 days.
Yeah.
In a very light, fluffy, like, not.
And I've noticed this too, how often I've put stuff on the internet and then immediately checked my direct messages or my comments because I need validation and I want you to comment on, tell me how good I'm doing. And so that's why I've recently turned off my comments for a little while.
Like, I know. I watch your stories. I'm like, damn it. Why can't I?
You can't say anything because it's either like, you're hot or like, I really want to quit drinking, but I'm not going to quit drinking. And then,
what do you think about that?
Yeah. And I don't want to talk about it. I'm sorry. I don't want to talk about it. If you know me and you really want to get a hold of me, you can figure it out.
I know. I got confused.
But it's the same way that people use the term, I'm so bipolar. Sorry, that's the voice that I assigned to that. But I was just like, if you had any idea, but that I'm so bipolar, mm-hmm. and me realizing and getting that diagnosis that I actually am bipolar. And then when people say it, I'm just like, oh man, if you really knew what that was,
you would not be saying that out.
You would not throw that term around. And it wouldn't be a joke. Yeah.
And that's kind of just in all the work that we've done for alcohol issues, like to say someone, like when people joke or be like, I'm an alcoholic, or like, I was so drunk this week. Like, and I know that a lot of that has to do with my story, but I don't take that the same way as I used to. Mm-mm. Yeah.
No, and not when I don't look at everybody different when they drink. It's interesting. I realize now how much a lot of people around me don't drink now that I'm not drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have a good group around me for right now.
I hate when a lot of people are like, I'm OCD. I'm so OCD.
That's and a big blah, thing blah. Too. Yeah.
Like, really? Because I actually, like, I understand that pretty well. Yeah. And you're just annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really were OCD, you wouldn't tell people because it would be embarrassing to you.
It would be consuming your brain right this second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just because you have 4 post-it notes in your purse.
And you've got your pens lined up on your desk. That does not mean you're OCD.
No, not even a little bit. This is not what we're talking about.
What are we even doing right now?
I don't
know.
We're all over the place.
What? How are things going? I mean, we don't even have... What time?
What time is it? We don't even know.
Where am I?
Oh, we have enough time to do an episode.
Welcome to Not Terrible with your hosts, Jess Hooker and Mary Graham. Jess is a part-time vegan yogi. You can find her on her motorcycle, usually heading to therapy. Mary is a writer and Jesus follower. She loves camping almost as much as cheeseburgers. The Not Terrible podcast is two childhood friends who have been through the ringer, learned some tough lessons, and kept going. Jess and Mary share stories, advice, and lessons on each episode. They try to find humor in the chaos and learn from their mistakes in an attempt to feel less alone as they navigate life's journey.
What do you want to talk about?
I think we'll talk about... You want to talk about the grief?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about that. The grief. Grief, obviously, when you think of it, we think of death, and usually physical death, the passing of a loved one or a pet or... That's about it, but sorry, I didn't mean to, that's a very heavy thing to say and then to make light of it, but grief comes in so many forms, and Mary has said this a lot, not only on the podcast, but in conversation about death of other things and the grief that comes with it, whether it be relationships, habits, addictions, jobs, careers, dreams, futures. There's just, we were talking about it before we started this podcast, and death is just very, very present right now, and not in a physical way. And some things have happened in my personal life recently that have been kind of physical death and also death of a relationship, mainly the one with my ex-husband. And we were talking about some things that were going on between us on the phone, and then the following day a quote popped up on Instagram, and it's from Dr. Alexandra Solomon, and it says, "A breakup is the death of an imagined future." And I sent that to him, and I just said, strange that this popped up. Sometimes things have to die to let other things grow, and we're going to grow. We're just not going to grow the way we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I believe you. And it's really, really nice that I believe our friendship is going to grow since the death of our relationship. We always kind of said that we were friends before we were anything,
mm-hmm.
but to see how our friendship can grow and how we can support each other that way now, I'm kind of excited about it. And you probably more than anybody know that I have not been excited about it for a long time.
That's very true.
Yes.
So for the very first time I heard grief out of the context of an actual physical death of like someone dying was when I started going to Lisa, and I was just so angry. And it was Chris had been caught drinking, admitted to being an alcoholic only to appease people, and then was secretly drinking for a couple months after that before we separated and he went to rehab. So that summer I was angry. Now I know I was angry because I knew in my bones, I knew he was still drinking and I wasn't.
You weren't listening to yourself.
Yeah. And I was just trying to survive. But so Lisa, and I couldn't understand why I was just so angry all the time. And she said that in the stages of, you know, like healing, one of them is grieving the loss of the life you thought you were going to have. And I, at first, didn't really understand what that meant because I was still alive. Like, but there were parts of me, my heart, my like future, my family, things were dying, and I didn't understand that they were just as important to acknowledge and let be sad and not just rationalize away, because when you say you are grieving something, it almost, as someone who has also lost people, it sounds like you're taking away what would be important for actual death,
mm-hmm.
and you're equating it to me losing someone, and that's not the same. But a lot of the feelings in our bellies of just like loss feel similar. Mm-hmm. They show up differently in our lives, but this idea that, I no longer have something I thought I was going to have, and you're allowed to be sad and be angry and go through all the cycles of grief with something that technically still could be, but it's not. It went away. And we didn't bury it. It's not in a graveyard, but it's gone. So a friendship, a marriage, a spouse, a dream, a job, all kinds of things. When we lose something, we have to feel all the emotions attached to the loss of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I'd ever realized that in many ways, been grieving lots of things throughout my life. I just didn't know the words for it. And it showed up as anger because I didn't ever sit with it long enough to ask what was underneath it.
When you said the loss of the life you thought you'd have, the first time I had that feeling, it's probably not the first time I had that feeling, but in my adult life, how I remember it, was when I was full of anger as I watched Addie regress and realizing, like, over time, over years, really, like, wow, this kid's not ever going to drive a car, and she's not going to go to college, and she's probably not going to get married, and she's never going to have kids, and just all the... and mourning the loss of the daughter I thought I'd have. Wow. Like that's grief that I'm going to carry for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And at times anger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what feels maybe more unfair in that is every time a new milestone comes with people her age,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have it again.
Yeah.
And that is a really hard,
mm-hmm.
like, realization to know that when you feel like you've grieved something, there's going to be something else.
Yeah.
That's going to pop up.
And we're noticing it now as younger cousins and younger friends are maturing past Addie. Girls that have kind of always looked up to Addie as the cool older one,
mm-hmm.
and they're just kind of seeing her differently, seeing her more for exactly what she is at this moment, instead of being like, oh my gosh, this cool teenager is hanging out with us. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
That's what's currently hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it'll be, I guess, do you brace yourself or do you try not to look too far ahead? Because I don't know, I could see me doing both things and being angry if I look ahead, or if I don't look ahead and then I feel blindsided. Like, I don't know how you handle.
Yeah, I don't know either right now. It just depends on the mood, you know, like if I want to feel bad for us and be angry about it, then that's what I do. I'll kind of
just slip into that.
Yeah. I'll just mm-hmm. be angry about everything and just think about all the things we're going to miss out on. But her doctor said a long time ago, like at 16, she'll probably just plateau, like whatever, like everything will probably just stop about that age. That's usually what it is.
Hmm.
And so I've kind of just always had 16 stuck in my head.
Yeah.
But recently I've just been listening to podcasts and doing a lot of my own research about the brain and the frontal lobe, and that's where her malformation is, and that it doesn't really stop developing until you're 25. And so I kind of have a lot of prayer and hope based on just new things that I've found out.
Yeah.
So.
Hmm. For my marriage, it's odd to say I was grieving things when I was actively still married, because I look back at my wedding pictures and see this like innocent, fresh faced, way too tan, like just 25-year-old kid who didn't know what she was getting into, and not just like, man, I just didn't understand marriage was hard, or like, oh man, life is hard and things suck. But like, I didn't know the degree of addiction and just devastation that I was inviting in, that I was agreeing to. And so even though Chris and I are still married, I have spent a lot of time, especially the first year of his recovery, grieving the innocence of my life before, and grieving. So when, like, this is not an encouraging thing to say, but sobriety is going to be a struggle for the rest of his life in some way or another. He doesn't have the active desire to drink anymore. Like, he doesn't think about, like, it is no longer his first thought, or there's an obsession that comes with addiction that he doesn't have. He has said that he does not have that anymore. But the minute you stop paying attention is when it creeps back in. So this is for the rest of our marriage. This will be a forefront issue. I grieved the life that would have been easier. Mm-hmm. Like, I
just
grieved
the normal arguments, the regular celebrations, the just this not being an issue.
Right. And like marriage in general, agreeing to spend your life with one person mm-hmm. and for the rest of your life, and like trying to figure out how to not kill each other and how to still love each other. Like, in general, marriage is hard. We have added an extra layer with addiction, and I grieve the less hard version of my life that I could have had. And my counselor would say, you have the option not to have that. Like, you could stop that.
Right.
And what I do a lot of times is weigh hards. Getting divorced and being a single mom and is a hard life versus being married and actively trying to live a sober recovery life with my husband. Either one of my choices is hard. What hard do I want today?
Right.
And up until this point, I've picked the hard of being married to a recovering alcoholic. But it's also, I think, for me, easy to romanticize the idea that if I wasn't married to Chris, things would be so much easier. And that's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. It's always, you know, it's really easy for us to think the grass is always greener on the other side. Mm-hmm. I'm just picking what heart I want right now. Now that I understand the field, I can see clearly all my options, what I'm getting into, what I'll accept and what I won't. Like, I'm just picking the hard. But grieving the loss of my innocence, grieving the trust that was in my marriage, all those things, that especially that first year was really, really hard. And I needed a counselor to tell me that it was okay, because then I would feel guilty about being this upset about something that I thought I should just be able to handle better.
Right. My dad told me two things when I got divorced, and I've been divorced for 10 years legally. You don't lose your problems when you get divorced. You just exchange them for another set of problems. Mm-hmm. And he said, divorce is like death, except you have to see that person every day for the rest of your life. Specifically when you have kids.
Yeah.
It's something has died, but nothing is gone. And he was right. It does. It takes years to get over. Because every time you see that person, or every time there's something nasty said, or every time something triggers an old memory or an old hurt or an old bad decision, that wound is open all over again. And you're right back there sitting in your feelings.
Yeah. I mean, because if you think about it, our hearts weren't made to have something taken away like that. Like, mm-hmm. Ideally, it would work out. So then when it doesn't, when a dream or a job or a kid or a relationship or a family, whatever it is, doesn't work out, our hearts don't know what to do. Like, and when you lose something, it's not like that the next time you get better at losing, it still hurts just as much. Like, there is no, like,
right. You don't get
at 50, I'm going to be great at losing. It's right. Still going to suck. I'm still going to, like, if you love anything and it goes away, mm-hmm. a part of you dies. Like, that's how it works.
Yeah. You're made up of these relationships and these feelings and these people. And when one of those things is gone, a part of you is gone.
Yeah. And maybe that's what pisses me off so much, is like, that this doesn't ever get easier. Like, if you heal or you grieve and then you have some kind of peace, like, it will come again.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, the only way to avoid it is to not engage in your life.
Right.
And some people do that.
Yeah. That's usually where addiction lies.
Yeah.
But that's what's so... I'm sorry, it's not funny, but it's a little bit funny. That
loopy right now.
Whenever you're met with, I don't know.
Struggle?
Struggle, maybe. Yeah, maybe that's the word I'm looking for. Whenever you're met with something that's not according to plan, you're like, all right, okay, bring it on. We're going to experience this and we're going to learn how we're going to do better. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be ready next time and we'll be prepared and we have our notes and here we are. Well, with grief, you don't have that.
No.
That's not an option.
Mm-mm.
And so I think that that's probably why this is one of your bigger struggles, is
yeah.
because there's no way to be better at it next time, to be more prepared.
Yeah. Because that's my brain goes to, okay, why did this not work well?
Right.
Let's figure that out. It's a puzzle. And then I will do this better next time to avoid this issue. And there is no figuring out grief to skip it next time.
Right. I feel like you're an English teacher by trade, but you kind of have a science teacher's brain. Like, that's how you approach things. As like, all right, this
like
is
formulas.
The experiment.
Yes,
this is the experiment. This is, and it's a lot of,
Yeah, that's true. That's the Enneagram 8, like, logical steps. This
right.
and this, black and white, this plus this equals this. So if I don't add this one next time, then it'll be a different answer. Mm-hmm. And that serves me well in some things and makes me very successful and good at some things. But also, like, you know, it just like anything, it's not beneficial in all parts of my life.
Yeah. where in grief, I thrive when it comes to other people. Like, oh, just something bad has happened. Well, let's comfort you as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't serve me in terms of being an Enneagram 2 that I don't like to be taken care of when grief comes. I don't want to accept help. I don't want to be nurtured. I do when I'm unhealthy. I do want those things, but then I want to complain about them when they don't happen.
Yeah.
But a healthy me would just be able to say, yes,
I need
bring
help.
Me a meal. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah, make me an appointment with my therapist. Yes. I would love for you to come over and just listen to me, like those things. But I'm immediately like, nope, I'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Which is, again, addiction or depression, like the isolation to avoid the bad thing. Because if you don't have to acknowledge it, then it doesn't have to be there.
Yeah.
I think learning for the first time that I was allowed to grieve things that did not physically die gave me a little freedom. A lot of my therapy has been about Lisa telling me whatever I'm feeling is okay. And I think both of our stories, in different ways, we have been told that our feelings are not appropriate, or that we are not allowed to feel what we feel because it doesn't make sense to someone else. So then me being 30-something and being told for the first time, like, there is nothing wrong with this feeling that you have. You don't have to have any guilt, any shame, any hiding. Like, you are allowed to have this feeling for as long as you want. It will go away if you do this correctly. Yeah. If you just let it be there, you won't stay there.
Mm-hmm.
There was almost some freedom. Not that it saved my heart from pain, but I can like step back from myself a little bit more, understand what I'm feeling, even just in the level of like, man, I feel sad right now. I don't know why, but I'm sad and I'm okay with that. Like, I'm allowed to be sad right now. And then feeling your emotions without the guilt or need to rationalize them. I think that gave me some kind of just
permission,
a little more peace. Not that it made it easier, but that it was one less thing I had to worry about. Yeah. I don't have to hide what I'm feeling. I'm allowed to be whatever I'm feeling. I'm not allowed to hurt other people because of what I'm feeling, but right. I'm allowed to have those feelings.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know about feelings? Feelings are visitors. They will come and go.
That was your mom voice.
I don't know where I heard that, actually. Somebody else told me that, like a therapist when I was a kid or something.
It's true. I don't know where I heard that. Something similar where it's just like, or maybe it's when we were talking about like things can pass through. You don't have to grab onto them and keep them as your own forever.
Right.
Like, okay, cool, but I want everything I see. So, like, if I feel something, I'm going to grab onto it and keep it.
Right. And I think that something that I learned from Lisa in terms of non-death grief was sit. She would say, just sit with it. Just sit in your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Just sit there. And a lot of times when she would say that, I was wallowing. Not necessarily sitting, but more like
you were camping.
I was setting up camp. I had all those fun signs and
you got the lights strung up.
Oh yeah, it was a place to be. I was gonna be there for a while.
Which is odd because I'm the exact opposite. I'm like, right. One day, what can we move on now?
Mm-hmm.
So she told you to pick up the pace.
Kind of. I think when I realized when she said you need to sit in it. There was sit in it is what she would say. And I was just sitting in it. I wasn't actively doing anything with it. I wasn't trying to work through it.
Pay attention to it.
I wasn't even feeling it. Yeah. I was just like, yep, this is where we are.
I'm just going to carry this now.
Yeah, we're angry, depressed, and drinking. Mm-hmm. Let's do this.
Yeah.
And well, I was going to be the best angry, depressed, drunk person there ever was.
Yeah.
I was going to wear it like a badge, and that's what I was doing. But instead of just being angry, knowing what I was angry about, going, you know what, this is depression, and what am I going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Do I know that these episodes can last 2 weeks? Yeah. And do you know sometimes you're just going to have to write them out? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of where it came to, instead of basically adding fuel to the fire like I was.
You were sitting in it but not paying attention to it.
No.
Like getting in there and then like pretending like it wasn't there.
Yeah, kind, but I was acting it. I had that attitude.
Yeah,
I had
and you were attitude. Working hard to hurt other people while you were in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, if I'm gonna be in this hole, you're gonna be right down here with me.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I remember going in the last couple of months and going, okay, when you said sit in it, I get it. That's not what you meant. Now I know what you meant. Actually,
take two.
Yeah, actually feeling the feeling. And letting it pass, not grabbing onto it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just, yes, feel it until you don't feel it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it will go away unless you work really hard to keep it.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So we talked a little bit about when, I think in the Adult Children of Alcoholics episode, how... For Chris's family of origin, there is just a lot of hurts behind that. So we are no longer, I don't know if I said this in the episode or I've just written about it, but we are no longer in relationship with either one of his parents. And the longer that goes, the more we realize that it's a good thing and not a, like, when it started, there was this kind of question of like, well, how long is this going to be? Like, what do we need to address? Like, how do we get back to a place where there can be a relationship and in a way that I don't think either one of us saw coming is instead of time away to heal, it's been time away to realize that it doesn't need to be there anymore. And while he doesn't want his mom or dad back, he has had to start actively grieving the life that he deserved as a kid and the parents that he deserved as a person of value and what he actually had. So neither one of his parents are dead. They're both still alive. But he is doing a lot of grieving of his parents, of his childhood. And that's a weird thing to say. He is sad and grieving people that are alive that he could have in his life if he allowed it. But he's not because he knows it's not a good idea. So he is in essence, sent people away. And now he has to grieve their loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tricky...
That seems strange. If you're making the choice for them to not be a part of your life, then why grieve them if you don't want them around at all? But that's not the thing. We're not grieving what we're losing in this moment. We're grieving what we deserved, like
yeah.
you just said. Like, you, like everybody deserves two healthy parents, mm-hmm. two parents that are going to protect you, two parents that are concerned about your well-being and your mental
yeah.
health and your physical health. And there's...
And they just love you
that just
in a
love
safe
you. Yeah.
way that that doesn't make you feel scared.
Yeah, that doesn't mm-hmm. make you feel like you have to escape.
Yeah. So he is grieving then the loss of his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't something that we use these words to talk about with our kids, but my kids are 8 and 10 and they still remember Chris's parents. And Chris's dad was not around enough for my kids to actually have a relationship with them. They are aware of him, but
mm-hmm.
they, you know, like, what is dad's name again? Like,
yeah.
what did we call him? But Chris's mom was, she was around a lot. And
mm-hmm.
my kids are grieving the loss of their grandma.
Gosh, I mean, I was around when she was around.
Yeah.
And on the surface, she looked like a good grandma.
Yeah. Like
yeah.
She paid attention.
Yeah.
She played. She came over when we asked. So for them in their world and in their brain, she was fun. And it's they do not understand why she's not around anymore. And a lot of that is just like we give them what's appropriate for their age, and it's not appropriate to tell them some of the things that are behind the reasons for Daddy to not want her around anymore. But I can't use the words grief for my kids because they don't understand that either. But we are, you know, for 2 years now, I've been watching my kids grieve a loss of a grandparent. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. Harder than maybe some of my own grief, because I want to protect my kids. Mm-hmm. And we are protecting them, which is why she's not around anymore. But they don't understand that.
No, no. And they will. There will come a time when that conversation happens and they have questions that mm-hmm. you have to answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And as they get older, we give them a little bit more information, not as a way to withhold things, but it's not appropriate for an 8-year-old to know how her daddy grew up. And
no.
And it's not really appropriate for a 10-year-old to know that the household that her dad grew up in was scary. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that she'll have to know one day to help her make a decision, because there will be a point when she's 18 and she's an adult and she gets to decide whether that woman is in her life. And we will have to make sure she has enough information to make a choice that's safe for her.
Yeah. And I think that there might be people listening now and going, well, how do you know when your kids are ready for that information? Your kids will ask.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we answer the questions. Yeah. Yeah, we answer the questions that they ask. We don't go into detail. Mm-hmm. We just answer
truthfully
yeah. what they need to know. Mm-hmm. And there is some abuse that my kids don't need to know about at 8 and 10. Mm-hmm. That when they're more aware of sex and their bodies and things like that, man, I don't know, though. I don't look forward to that day.
Yeah.
And that might just be a very surface-level conversation, too, of like, hey, here's some things that happened to your dad that your grandma and grandpa allowed.
Mm-hmm. I have a...
I don't know about
that. I know
that.
This isn't necessarily on the topic of this, but as someone who experienced some of the same things, I have a book, and I think that parents that did are a lot more proactive in protecting their children. Mm-hmm. And I have a book that I would pass along to you guys mm-hmm. if you wanted it.
Yes, please. Yeah. And we are grieving things that we don't even know about, too. Like for Chris, sobriety, the work of recovery is slow. And I know we've talked on here and in person about early sobriety is 5 years. And I didn't really understand that completely when he first came out of rehab. But I can tell you 2 years in, we are learning and he's feeling and seeing and paying attention to things that he couldn't have paid attention to a year ago. He couldn't have paid attention to 2 years ago. And I am slowly learning that. Yeah, I think the next few years are still going to be really rough as the clouds fade. And our brains are meant to protect us, too. And if you have spent a long, long time numbing and avoiding, your brain knows when it's safe to kind of open new things. And we're starting to open some new things that he wouldn't have been able to handle a year or two ago. There's a lot of grief that's still happening. Like when we learn or he says out loud things that he's not said before. And it's just a whole nother level of just like,
all right, death. Here's something else.
Yeah.
And I think that, not to put a timestamp on it, but 5 years seems like a transitional time, to let the death of that you go. I mean, Chris is mourning the death of the person he anticipated being forever.
Yeah.
Flaws.
Yep.
Abuse.
Secrets.
All of it. Traumas. Yeah. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
That was who he had signed up to be for all of his adulthood up until 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And letting that person go and going, I'm making the choice to be different. That's uncomfortable.
Yeah. Oh man. And even just you saying that. So as our kids get older, he's just seeing more and more spots of childhood and life that he missed out on. And so he is actively grieving his 8-year-old self and 10-year-old self as he's parenting an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I think that will continue. So he, you know, as my kids get older, they continue to grow up in a safe environment, he will see again and again what he missed. And just like, I don't say it lightly when I tell you that he will be in counseling for the rest of his life. And a lot of it is just because the slow realization over and over again. Somebody commented on Instagram last week after I posted that he was 2 years sober, and somebody said, I can't imagine waking up every day and fighting again. And that's what he's doing. That's what you're doing. So like, it is a celebration, but it's also like, it's a bittersweet celebration that this has to be what your life is, or that you, that it's you fight.
Yeah. It's a celebratory battle. I mean, sometimes it's every minute, and other times you get a whole day, but it feels like you battle more than you celebrate, but
and it won't always be like that, but no, it just takes so much time.
It's the transition of letting that old person die. And I hope that, I think it could be a wonderful form of therapy, like in addition to everything else that Chris is doing, is to when he sees 8-year-old and 10-year-old self and his own girls, like the grace and the love that he gives them, to give that to 8 and 10-year-old Chris.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard thing to do, but sometimes you have to self-parent.
Yeah.
Even at this moment.
Yeah. And he's
not just self-parent adult you have to go back and parent that child that wasn't given that unconditional love that he deserved.
Yeah. I have a friend who, she has a book coming out in January called Try Softer, and she's a therapist, and I went to a writing conference with her a couple years ago. But just what you're kind of saying about like not just reparenting yourself now, but like being more grace filled with that child that you were, and realizing,
it's actually a form of therapy, and we'll look it up, and I don't know what it's called exactly.
So I would love to have her on next season to talk about like what does try softer mean? What does it mean for you as a child to, as an adult, to look back and forgive yourself as a kid and be kinder to the kid you, and then what does that look like now? But that was on my list of things to talk about.
Oh, good.
But not on this podcast.
No. That's how it goes. Yeah, I have 2 or 3 books about self-parenting.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Yep.
Moving on. But you were talking about a second ago, to revisit this and then we'll wrap up, talking about how things unfold with sobriety. Things that your brain would not have been able to handle early in sobriety, or even drunk you, that was just numbing those things and trying to keep those things at bay. I think maybe I'll talk about this in a later episode, but not right this minute, because it's a pretty heavy thing. But something that happened to me while I was still drinking and not having all of the medical facts at the time, and now that I'm sober, getting those facts and going, hey, this is what was happening to your body, I am so thankful that I didn't get that information then, because I got it when God was ready for me to have it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when my brain was ready to go, oh wow, that's what's going on.
Yeah. Because just in general terms, I think about all the truths that we get at just the right time, because if it had come sooner, it might have killed us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes when you want all the answers, when you are grieving and you want to know why, you're not ready for your why at that moment.
Yeah.
And I think that we all get the information that we need as we can handle it.
Yeah.
All right.
Do you want to do a Not Terrible? Somebody is complaining on Instagram that we haven't been doing them all the time.
We haven't.
I
been
know.
Doing
and I was like, well,
time.
We've sometimes dropped the ball.
Sometimes we're just freaking tired.
Yeah, I don't have anything to be happy about.
No, that's not true. I have a really odd Not Terrible.
Okay.
So a couple of weeks ago, I went to a Rotary Steak and Bake as an invitation from an old college friend that I hadn't seen in about a year. And he and his wife, we've remained friends, and he said, hey, I know you're single. Do you want to go to this? I have one
extra
ticket.
Do you want to meet
ticket.
A grandpa at this Rotary dinner?
Exactly. So he said, do you want to go to this? And I said, sure, yeah, I'll go. And it was funny because he's not on social media, but his wife is. And his wife, as soon as I got there, he comes up to me and he said, hey, Gina told me that I can't I can't give you a hard time about not drinking, and I can't pressure you, so I'm just saying that I'm not going to do that. But I'm sober right now, but I can't promise that later I'm not going to do it. And they were wonderful and great, and it was fine. It was a weird event to be sober at, though. Anyway, it paid off. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But I have amazing beginner's luck. I don't know if anybody knows that, but
no.
I do. Whenever I try something for the first time, casino, gambling, Rotary Club Steak and Bake, I'm going to win.
What? I had no idea. I didn't know this about you.
I know. I usually don't share it because I was kind of superstitious. You want to
brag. Yeah.
But it's for real. So they did a, what are they, is that a reverse raffle? Yeah, it was a reverse raffle where they put everybody's names up on the big board,
mm-hmm.
and then they draw numbers throughout the night, and as they draw numbers, your name is next to a number, they take your name down.
You're out if
yeah.
your number
so there's
is
like
down.
200 people on this board. Well, I'm the last 16, and I kind of wasn't paying attention to it because I was like, whatever, I'm going to eat my steak and my baked potato. And as the night progressed, I kept going up there, and I was like, oh. Me and two other people at our table were still in it. The other two people were married to each other. So 16, yeah. So there's 16 of us, and then there's 10 of us. And then when the 10 of us are up there, they call you up on stage. I wasn't familiar with how all this worked. So once you're up there, there's $2,000. There's 10 people. If everybody decides to split it, everybody gets $200. But one person says no to splitting it, they draw another name. So
I'm getting stressed.
I know. It told me I had to poop while I was up there.
I'm
just
nervous shits right
yes,
now.
Right now. So they draw a number, and because somebody said, no, I'm not going to split it. And it makes it a lot more fun if you're watching, especially. It does not make it fun if you're up there. And then so we get it down to the fifth person, and the fifth person is they're like, okay, are we going to split? And they said no. So they draw another name. Now I'm in the top four. So it's me, another old lady, and this couple that's married. So they're going to make twice as much money no matter what. When it was the four of us, we decided that we'd split it. So we each got $500.
Nice.
I just got that check in the mail.
It's been weeks, right?
It's been weeks,
yeah.
Yes. I just got that check, and my brother-in-law called and said, hey, do you want to go in on a bus? We bought a bus, and now we're selling the bus for substantially more than what we paid for
like
it.
Like five times more than you paid for it.
I know. And so,
what is happening? Beginner's luck on bus flipping.
I know, right? So I think I found my new job.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So it was a weird thing that happened that I wouldn't have normally just said, yeah, here's $500 of mine that you can just.
Yeah.
But I had it and I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Well, I hope that all the people that follow you on Instagram are listening because you posted a picture yesterday and were like, bought a bus. And like, you have the comments off on your Instagram. And I know your phone where I could text you. But I was just like, oh no, this is a disaster. Like I was. And I told you when I was driving over here today, like driving down your road, I'm like, okay, do not be negative about why she bought this bus. If she tells you she's going to live in it, do not make a big deal about it. Like, I was just like, stay calm. Do not use your facial expressions to tell her that this is a bad idea. And then you're like, we sold it. And I was like, oh God, thank God.
Yeah. The most that we were going to do is when you start to convert a bus to live in or to camp in, you have to strip everything and insulate it because mm-hmm. school buses are loud
and cold.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So that was the most we were going to do, is basically get it to a point where somebody would be able to just go in there and make
design
it.
Design it, yeah.
So that was the most. And I was like, yeah, I can do that with this little 16-passenger bus. Yeah. It'll be fine. But then when he told me, he was like, hey, hope you're having a good night. By the way, I'm going to sell this bus. And I was like, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And I sent some really funny meme of somebody like just flipping dollar bills everywhere.
Making it rain.
May have been a stripper. I don't know. Okay, so what's your not terrible?
Well, I didn't make a lot of money or win any money. It's the beginning of October. I don't know when this is coming out. We've already done this at this point, but
okay.
Fall break's coming up. We've got fall break with our kids the next couple weeks, and the Grahams are, as Harper Graham calls it, going old-fashioned camping. We're not taking our camper. We're leaving the dogs. We're taking the tent and our car, and we're taking off for 10 days.
That's awesome.
And we're going to go northeast. I don't think we'll get all the way to Maine, but we've got more states up there that we haven't visited yet on our goal to hit all 50 states. So we're going to start on a Thursday night and see how far we can get, how many states we can visit, how many state parks and national parks. And we're going to take a little road trip. And we're going to stay in, like, cheap motels when we need to shower.
Yeah.
And just, like, when we camp in our camper, we set up a whole thing. Like, the rugs are out and the lights are up. And
it's
like
very
all
much
the,
a living.
Yeah, yeah, it's, like, a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work to pull a camper, set it up, and tear it down. And just, you can travel faster if you don't have a camper. So we're going to tent camp, like, very low frills. Like, I'm not camping over, I'm not making food over a fire. We'll, you know, have a cold breakfast and be on the road to eat. And we're just... Chris and I are very, very excited. This is how we used to camp before we got the camper. My children...
I thought you were going to say before we had the kids.
And before we had the kids. Well, we didn't get the camper until Harper was four.
Sorry.
Until Ellie was four. Harper was two.
They were
little. They don't remember tent camping at all.
But they are angry about it.
They are not happy about it at all. Like, both of them are angry about this trip. And I will leave them behind in a state park if they don't get their act together.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good luck in Rhode Island.
All right. That was good. I'm glad we brought it back.
Yeah.
Can I borrow $20?
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
You've been listening to Not Terrible with Jess Hooker and Mary Graham. Connect with the podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Not Terrible Podcast. Visit them at NotTerriblePodcast.com for show notes and additional content. You can sign up for their newsletter to receive bonus episodes and podcast extras. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast provider. Not Terrible is recorded in conjunction with The Chick McGee Show and Off the Air Podcast. Recorded in the Front Room Studio, this has been a Waco production.